Hi there, and welcome back to the Resilient Campus podcast. I'm so grateful for your support and your time and your energy that you are devoting to our community and our overall campus social movement building. I'm grateful that you're here. Today's guest is TJ Jurian, and I wanted to provide some highlights about our discussion today that you can look forward to and that you definitely won't want to miss. In our conversation today, TJ tells us about his current work researching campus climate, and he has a really innovative model that he is using as a scholar on campus to inform campus climate work. And he has me thinking really deeply about this work of microclimates that I've heard about before, but hadn't really dove too deeply into. And so it really kind of poked and prodded to me to actually move that inquiry forward. And so that's my next call to action, is to look into microclimates. So listen in closely for what those calls to action for you are, and what's that next point of inquiry and that next point of growth that you're engaging in as a person, as someone contributing to this work as a professional, and just as a well-rounded human being in our communities. What is that next point of learning and growth? And TJ talks about how this scholarship offers an opportunity to really check the pulse of campus regarding college and university inclusion. He describes how he then connects that scholarship with informing policy and practice. And I know that this is sometimes a time-delayed process if, you know, scholars are publishing books and they have to wait for that to come out in order to inform practice. And TJ really addresses how to do that and close that gap of integrating that work into policy and practice. So listen closely for that as well. I love learning this early story about TJ, and he talks about the first time he had to tell a college president no. And as a student activist, as an undergraduate student, more so, that was a very pivotal and essential learning experience that shapes who he is and how he does his work today around student activism and now activism and resistance as a professional within these systems of higher education. He encourages each of us to find our own happy places, or what he calls an escape room or escape rooms. And this is really essential, and I want you to listen in closely for the reflective question that he provides each of us as we think about how to determine what those happy places are for each of us and what those escape rooms are for each of us as we work towards balance and trying to cultivate balance in our lives. He provides a phenomenal array of resources that included books and podcasts, from arts and culture to sports to academic disciplines of gender studies and sociology, etc. To close out, TJ discusses the salience and the vulnerability of his immigrant identity and discusses how that connects to his identity as a trans person. And so that's a really important piece that I'm so grateful that we had a chance to talk about that at the conclusion of our discussion today. And then we close out by providing TJ's contact information so that you can add him to your network as we deepen our relationships in this work and we try to build networks of connectivity. That is one of the call to actions for each episode, is really think about how you can engage with each of the guests and add them to your network so that we can really broaden our reach in this movement and be in direct contact with each other, whether it's through social media or email. So get out of your way for now. Please do enjoy the episode with TJ Jurian. Episode number 23 of the Resilient Campus Podcast. Today we're speaking with TJ Jurian. TJ Jurian is a social justice educator, a learner, activist, and speaker, having worked with hundreds of college campuses, conferences, and community-based organizations across Turtle Island. In 2005, TJ was featured in the Sundance docuseries Transgeneration, depicting a single academic year in the lives of four trans college students at four different institutions, and giving him a platform from which to amplify justice work. Motivated by intersectional and liberatory movements and lenses, he brings his personal, communal, and professional perspectives into all kinds of classrooms, and his empowering and dynamic presentations speak to a variety of audiences, from staff members and students to faculty and broader community members. TJ's professional experiences span LGBTQ life, residential life, women's center work, multicultural affairs, orientation, and leadership. Currently, his research and advocacy center queer and trans people of color in achieving the democratic and liberatory potentials of higher education. TJ co-founded T-Circle, the only collective by and for trans educators in higher education and student affairs,
and co-founded the Interdisciplinary and Open Access Journal of Critical Scholarship on Higher Education and Student Affairs. TJ, thank you so much for being here, my friend. I'm really glad to have you and appreciate your time and energy. How are you?
I'm really good. It's always a pleasure to be in community with you, Sabi.
You as well. And I know that you spilled some of the beans in that bio, but tell us a little bit more about what you want listeners to know about you today.
Sure. And I'm going to try something new today. I think we're all really used to talking about sort of our jobs and the roles that we play in the world. And so basically what we produce. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what sort of produced me. I'm a product of stubborn survivors, people who faced genocide and wars and poverty and all kinds of different forms of brokenness. I'm someone who loves and hurts deeply, who is because others have been. And I'm a hopeless romantic in many aspects of my life, not just in terms of personal relationships. I'm inspired by intersectional movements, by activists, by scholar activists. And I come into all of this as someone who's been a first-generation student, a Middle Eastern, working-class background, performing in a middle-class world, fairly gender-conforming trans man, temporarily able-bodied, an immigrant, and then uncle, brother, son, friend, and a Gemini.
Thanks for being vulnerable with us and sharing those things and reframing how we think about what we're bringing with us into this work. So I really appreciate that. So can you share with us the work that you're doing today in higher education environments?
So a lot of my work currently, because of the professional role I occupy, tends to be in the world of scholarship. I just started here at Oakland about a year ago. And so I'm still sort of getting a feel for the university. So a lot of my work is much more in writing and in the classroom than it is necessarily really out in the community. When I get to a new environment, I like to be much more in a sort of stand back and listen and watch mode for a little bit, try to get really an understanding of the culture and the language and the dynamics on a college campus before I sort of jump in and tell people all the wrong things that they're doing, right? Because I'm the expert coming in from the outside that knows everything. So I'm spending some of my time getting to know folks. I try to sort of show up at this point, show up for my students in the classroom as well as out, and show up for the campus centers on campus, like the Gender and Sexuality Center and the Center for Multicultural Initiatives. So one of the things that I'm actually going to be working with the Gender and Sexuality Center with on this coming year is a new project. We are going to sort of have students help us create heat maps around campus, sort of plug in what spots on campus they experience as being affirming towards their identities and what spots on campus they experience as not being affirming for their identities. And so that we can really sort of visualize what campus inclusion looks like. What we're trying to do with this is see what sort of new information we can find out when we ask the same question that we've been asking in sort of campus climate surveys over and over again, but in a different way, right? In a different modality, and sort of find an aspect of students' worlds and experiences that they can't just answer in a Likert scale, right? And see what we can learn from it. Try to make it a little participatory and have the students sort of drive what we're going to do with it. Some of the ideas that we have right now is making it sort of like a portable gallery that we go around and students have opportunities to share their stories with other students and faculty and staff. And it becomes an opportunity for folks to do some reflection work and turn it into something actionable. Okay, so what do we do with this now that we're sort of really visualizing and seeing what this campus looks like? Outside of OU, a lot of it, like I said, it's in writing and research. I'm currently in a self-forming, still evolving sort of collective of trans and gender nonconforming scholars and scholar practitioners in higher ed. And we're trying to think a little bit differently, which oftentimes takes a little while when you're trying to do things different to the norm and how the structures of higher ed are. We're still learning. What we're trying to do is sort of be this cross-institutional collective that resist the singular individualistic sort of competitive nature that academia and student affairs exist in, right? And instead sort of really show up for each other, help lift each other's work and be there, support each other, right? Support, the word support doesn't really work a lot of times in the academy. You're supposed to sort of be very self-resilient and self-propelling. So the word support is really, I guess, resistant to that. But also then, how do we sort of bring all of our strengths and skills and knowledge and lived experiences together to build a whole different new research agenda that's driven by those that are the most marginalized in our communities, that's about making change happen for our communities as they're telling us, right? The more sort of we rise up in the ranks, we can sort of lose connection with folks on the ground. So we want to be in touch with folks who are students today and folks in the communities today, and then have this stuff really inform policy and practice. That these are sort of like the two buckets I'm in right now.
How do you bring colleagues to the table who might kind of be put on blast and be held accountable by these types of research methods? So that's my first question. And then I'm thinking about your last statement about informing policy and practice. How do you then bridge that gap? How do you move it there and so that it can be implemented at those policy levels or in daily practice?
I think one of the things that's exciting about this project is that people aren't really expecting themselves to be put on blast. I think especially well-meaning, well-intentioned, cis heterosexual folks have a perception that they maybe are really open and are really sort of accepting, or the word that folks a lot of times use, tolerant, right? Who wants that? Who wants to be tolerated? And so I don't think folks are expecting to be on blast. I think they're expecting to hear a lot of positive, and we might get that as well, right? And I think the element of surprise is actually going to work in our favor. If folks are going into it being worried about being found out, then we'll hit roadblocks, right? But currently, in the conversations we've been having with the person who functions in sort of a CDO role, they're enthusiastic about the project, and they want to see what we dig up. There's even been conversation about if this project really works out, about making it be part of regular campus pulse check-in initiatives, right? Broadening it to more than just queer and trans populations, but just a campus population as a whole, and try it out with different marginalized populations and see what we find. So the element of surprise, I think, is really going to help us out. And then we'll sort of see how folks react to that. The other, I think, benefit is to the location. I think here we contend a lot with the Michigan NICE, or the Midwest NICE that you might be familiar with as well in Minnesota, where folks sort of are really polite with each other and so aren't necessarily honest and authentic about the experiences that they're having, and don't put each other on blast, and, you know, and don't hold each other accountable or themselves accountable. And so I think, again, that element of the Midwest NICE might be unveiled a little bit in this project. In terms of the policy and practice translation, I think this is where the participatory aspect of it is really going to be instrumental. So as we're doing the project, it's going to be really important for us to really gain the students' trust and really make them feel heard and that we care about what they're putting across and what they're going to suggest for us. And then actually living up to that, right? So if students are consistently saying, this building is not a place where I find affirming, where my classes here are always, you know, I dread going to classes here, then it becomes incumbent on us, myself as the PI and the Gender and Sexuality Center, to make inroads with those faculty or those department heads or whoever we need to just start having a conversation and a dialogue and come at it from a, we want to help you make the best environment that you can for your students because we know that that's what you want. And the students are telling us maybe that you're not meeting your values fully. Right. So just kind of meeting people where they're intending to be and trusting that that's what they want and going from there. If we find that there's even more resistance, then I think we can take it up a notch at that point. But I think this is where relationship building becomes really, really key.
You know what I really love about that approach? I mean, there's a lot of things to love about it. One, you're creating this heat map to show inclusive spaces, to show affirming spaces, and then really highlight those areas on campus where departmentally, potentially, you can then target educational interventions for training and programming and speakers, you know, and just bringing in these like very micro-informed curriculums, in a sense. You know, we don't really know what their biggest questions or concerns or what students are experiencing within those physical environments. So that's really beautiful.
It really sort of builds on Anne-Marie Vaccaro's work. I mean, she sort of started doing this microclimate work to sort of say, doing just really broad campus climate stuff might tell us something on average, on an aggregate, on a mean, but means are only helpful to a limit, right? We really have to hone into specific areas, specific populations, and get to the granular to make a real lasting impact. And so that's the idea behind this project. Like with the Safe Zone example that you brought up, they're meant to be as general and as applicable across campus as possible in order to be able to, you know, be done several times a year, right? It takes a lot of work and a lot of effort to be really specific. And so that's what we're trying to do with this.
I love it. Is there any discussion throughout your project to kind of document how you're going throughout this process so that it can be replicated for other campuses to find out what their microclimates are?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, what we're doing is actually replicating other people's work. Grace Wojcik, who's the coordinator for the Gender and Sexuality Center here, and I were at a conference last year. It was the Great Lakes Regional something-something Student Success Conference. And Dr. Chris Wren, who's faculty at Michigan State, was there presenting on the project that she did at Michigan State that was very similar to what we're trying to do with Eric Pitcher, who was a doctoral student there at the time. And so it was in seeing that presentation that Grace and I talked about sort of doing this, something similar here at OU, and then having conversations with Eric about what did you try, what worked, what didn't work, and then sort of picking and choosing the aspects that we wanted to give a shot here at OU.
I love that. I love that. And so you're really helping to bring together and inform how students are encountering community, whether that's affirming, not affirming on particular spaces in campus. Tell us about where you find community.
I would say I find community with people and maybe my cat. That's, you know, the introvert has to have their non-people time, right? And that's with my cat. When I say with my people, I mean with my kin, right? People who are family, whether it's birth or chosen. So I find community with my one-year-old niece and my sister and brother-in-law when I get a chance to visit them in LA. I find community with my scholar fam because we know we get to nerd out together and not worry about having to explain our nerddom to those around us, as well as just explain our queerness and transness in that nerddom. But also because we're sort of connecting around trying to survive in this thing called academia without losing our souls entirely. And I would say it's with the family that I've met through the Brown Boy Project, like you, Savi, and whether it's folks like Kai and Pat and Tiffany and like all these folks that have meant so much for me.
Can you tell us about how you arrived to the work that you're doing today? Tell us about that journey and what brought you here.
I think there's probably a common thread around a lot of people's stories where there's someone in student affairs, right, who takes an interest in you and starts pushing you in that direction. I was really heavily involved in student activism when I was at Michigan State and with queer and trans activism primarily. Luckily, the first formal leadership position that I held was as an external vice chairperson of the Alliance for LGBTQ Students at State. And the Alliance was sort of the central queer organization, but there were several other ones. And the EVC's role was to be sort of like the connective tissue between all the different queer groups, and the QDPOC group was just starting that year. And also with all the other sort of identity and justice-based groups. So all the racial ethnic organizations, Women's Council, Council of Students with Disabilities, Students for Economic Justice, all of these groups. So I got to be sort of in all of these spaces while my leadership was evolving and developing, which was really, really cool and lucky for me. I still sort of am reflecting on the uniqueness of that role. One of the things that happened was Brent Bilodeau, this person that I mentioned, sort of said, you know, you could be doing this for a living, right? And he tricked me. So I got into student affairs. I was a business undergrad at the time, but I also had just come out as an anti-capitalist and a socialist. And so that doesn't really work out in those circles. It's kind of frowned upon to be a socialist. But I ended up going to the student affairs program at State, which is where I first met Chris Wren, and really got to learn a lot from her. She had just joined the faculty at the time. But the other thing that was happening in Michigan around that time was there was this convergence of a lot of sort of oppositional forces. This was the time when the University of Michigan affirmative action case was moving up to the Supreme Court. That was a Proposition 2 in 1 year to sort of ban affirmative action in Michigan. There was another Proposition 2 a different year that was about making sure that same-sex relationships are never given legal status. There was a lot of activity on campus around rape and sexual assault prevention. I think we see the result of folks not listening to those activists years and years ago today with Nasser and everything else being in the news and the not-so-effective John Engler and president role, as well as all kinds of different activism. One of the things that was occurring around this time when we were all building all these relationships together was that we had started becoming friends. So even though we were in these seemingly disparate spaces and seemingly disparate movements, we were connecting around just liking each other and being at parties together or eating meals together and sharing sort of our different strategies and our attempts at getting our voices heard. And I think it sort of just started clicking with us that we were competing with each other for airspace with the president. right? At the time, it was Peter McPherson, who's a really conservative guy, really resistant to any sort of justice efforts on campus. But I think he really thrived on sort of this divide and conquer mentality of, you know, I'll give you time and space, but that means I'm not going to meet with this group. And so we were all basically going at a small piece of the same pie. Instead, what we did was, what if we just sort of say no to that mentality and say no to the president? None of us had ever actually said no to what they were telling us that we needed to do in order to for them to show up for us. And so what we ended up doing was actually meeting together, creating a coalition, gave ourselves a different name, and building a sort of a unified student agenda. These are the things that we want to see our leadership do in order for this campus to be somewhere where we can actually thrive and succeed. And we refused to meet with the president one by one. We said, you either meet with all of us or none of us. And then if you meet with none of us, then we protest. And so he had to sort of concede. Gave us a room for, I think it was like 10 to 12 of us all showed up in the room with him. He still had sort of like this smug face on him of like, I still know how to deal with you students. But then as we went around, what ended up happening was a student who the president was used to engaging as the leader of the Asian Pacific American Student Organization said, I want to see gender identity in the anti-discrimination policy. And so his face started shifting and changing. Like, I wasn't expecting that to come out of your mouth, right? And then the next person who was the representative from Women's Council said, I want to see how you're going to make sure that all campus spaces are accessible to students with disabilities, right? And so we were doing things in an unexpected manner. And so he didn't know how to react to us and he couldn't shut us down, right? And so that's something that I learned and bring with me into my work still, is that in order to position ourselves to be change agents, we have to surprise the system, because the system and structures are really, really good at adapting. They're really good at sort of taking over radical spaces and radical initiatives and making it institutionalized and taming them down. And so by constantly surprising it, by constantly showing up in unexpected ways, it forces it to react instead of take us over.
I love that. So I can, that tells me a lot about who you are today, TJ, because that early socialization is pretty important to knowing how you promote your own activism and advocacy work. So I love knowing that about you.
I think the other thing that story also helps me remember is that back then, none of us had the language for what we were doing. We weren't calling this an intersectional whatever movement, right? We didn't have this language. We were just doing the things that we thought was going to have the most impact. And it reminds me that it's not about having the right words when you're doing the work, and that there are lots of folks in the community, in community organizations or spaces or at the church down the street who are doing this work that maybe are not calling it all these theoretical academic words that we're used to constantly saying. So if it's not called the social justice initiative of whatever, that I don't discount it because it might be showing up in just that way. And that just because something is called the social justice initiative of whatever doesn't mean that it's actually doing the work. It just might be the institutionalized version of what used to be doing the work.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for adding that to the conversation as well. Now, TJ, I know that you're very well read. What are those resources, books, podcasts that inform the way that you approach your work today?
So it's always dangerous to ask an academic to talk about books. This might take a little longer than maybe you expected, especially a Gemini academic, right? because and this is a sort of how being a Gemini shows up in my work a lot. It's impossible for me to think through one lens at a time. I have to sort of see it from multiple perspectives and bring all of those together. So I would say if I had to sort of distill it down to five books super quickly, I would say it's Roderick Ferguson's The Reorder of Things, The University and Its Pedagogies of Minority Difference, which is exactly about this concept of the institution de-radicalizing movements and making it their own and taming it down. Dean Spade's Normal Life, Administrative Violence, Critical Transpolitics, and the Limits of the Law, which, coming from a lawyer, tells us that law and policy isn't going to save us, but if we actually care about trans people's lives, this is how to approach it. Then I'd say it's Sara Ahmed's Queer Phenomenology, Orientations, Objects, Others. And this one, for me, there's a lot in this book, but a central piece that I pick out from it is that to really understand how we are orientated towards the word, towards the world, and she uses the word orientate, not orient. We have to disorientate ourselves to even notice, right? Otherwise, we're just following a script. Mm-hmm. Then it's R.W. Connell's Masculinities, because, you know, it's the text on hegemonic masculinity, and that's at the center of the work that I do, but also because it talks about how structures of power like hegemonic masculinity are crafty and changed and are adaptable. So they're not always noticeable in the ways that we think that they'll be seen. And then I would say it's Jose Munoz's Disidentifications, Queers of Color, and the Performance of Politics. This book beautifully sort of narrates the world-making processes of queer people of color. And it's sort of all of these books from outside of the higher ed and student affairs world that come in from American studies, race, gender, and sexuality studies, legal scholarship, performance studies, all of this stuff that I go to them because they tell me something new about the world and make me look at it from a different perspective, but also sort of push the edges of my own thinking. So, and I do the same thing with podcasts. I listen to a couple of higher ed ones. I listen to yours, and I listen to Scholar T with Shauna Patterson Stevens and Cameron Beattie, which I totally recommend to folks if for nothing else for Shauna's dad jokes. They're hilarious. But the rest of them, again, come from non-higher ed worlds. And they're things like Boom Lawyered and Beyond Prisons, which are both about sort of the legal system, criminal justice, and all kinds of different angles. Edge of Sports and Burn It All Down, which are both social justice themed sports podcasts, right? So it reminds me that social justice, all this work exists in lots of different worlds. And then there's Fortification, which is about spiritual fortification so that we can sort of sustain ourselves as we do liberation work, right? So it's all of these other sources that feed me and help me think about things differently and just sort of pushes me to get out of my silo and out of sort of the same way to think that we're constantly caught up in higher ed because we know each other, we go to the same conferences, we do the same programs, read the same books. So we're constantly regurgitating the same stuff over and over to each other.
Yeah, I appreciate that because what you're doing is you're really operationalizing how we actually live into an interdisciplinary field of practice and inquiry such as higher education. And what I will do is in the show notes, I will link every single one of those so that people can have easy access. They could just click through the list that TJ has provided today. So TJ, we're going to switch gears a little bit. What has been a big, important lesson that you've learned in your professional life? And what guidance would you provide to others that are doing this work that are listening today?
I would say if there's any one lesson that has been consistent throughout my life is the necessity to have escape environments. I know folks talk about sort of balance and well-being and work-life balance and all this stuff over and over again. But the need to just sort of really escape and on a daily basis and on a regular basis, somewhere where folks can decompress, where you don't have to take yourself too seriously, where you can just laugh, right, is really important. I have sort of like three of them. My daily one is my Instagram. I've sort of curated a space where, you know, I follow my friends, they're posting happy memories, I see their smiling faces. I follow cats and dogs and they're being cute. And whatever bunnies show up every once in a while. And I follow like Live Love Beirut, which is a photography one and that I get to see sort of my birthplace and I get to see the beauty of the place I came from. So like that's my happy place on a daily basis, right? The other escape place is the gym. So that's semi-regular, like, you know, 2-3 times a week, which I'll admit was a really, really tough place to sort of reclaim as a queer and trans person, as an escape place, right? Because in a lot of ways, it is very normative. And the bodies that are valued the most there are the normative bodies, right? But I think I really needed to do that. I really needed to struggle through it and reclaim it to sort of like take back something to claim that space and masculinity on my terms, right? And to see my body as lovable and as powerful. And as queer and trans people, we have such complicated relationships with our bodies. And so it was a friend of mine, actually, I mentioned him earlier, who met through Brown Boy, Pat Manuel. He's a boxer. He's a transmasculine person of color. And he's a total badass. And he taught me that, right? He taught me how to sort of like reclaim that space and reclaim my masculinity in that space. Another escape is sort of TV. And don't judge this, but it's the entire Bachelor franchise. I watch all of them, Bachelor, Bachelorette, Bachelor in Paradise, whatever. I watched the Olympics version. That was the dumbest one of all so far. But they're incredible to watch as like someone who theorizes gender and sexuality all the time and sort of like watch the absurdity of those shows. And it's silly candy to me, right? So I think having silly candy around the stuff that actually is really serious in your life can really help you sort of take it a little less seriously and then laugh at it a little bit. That's also why I don't yuck other people's yums. You don't know why they're yumming something, right? And so I guess if I'm sharing some guidance around folks figuring out what your escape environments are, maybe one of the ways is to sort of take stock of which one of your muscles you're regularly exercising, right? So for me, because I was exercising my brain muscles the most, like my head, I needed to sort of like refocus to my soul and my body, right? To sort of like balance that out. So I think of work-life balance, not in that sense of like, I have to have a balance around how much I work and how much I do leisurely things, but rather about how do I balance out different parts of my body and my mind and my soul and my different muscles so that they're sustaining each other and they're growing at similar rates instead of competing with each other for space.
That's really beautiful. I want to ask if there's anything else that you want to mention while we're on this call before we close it out.
I don't know if it's okay with you, but I wanted to talk a little bit about, there's a question that you tend to ask about identity saliency. I wanted to talk about that if that's okay.
Absolutely. Please.
So I thought about this because I listened to your podcast and I wanted to be ready. and I would say that while my trans identity and my masculinity sort of like show up on a constant basis because of the work I do, it's lately my status as an immigrant has been the one that's been at the forefront a lot more. Maybe obviously so for some folks who might have been noticing stories on immigration a lot more in the news lately, and nationally and internationally. But as someone who has been an international student, has been on H-1B visas, now I'm a permanent resident of the U.S., having this green card has sort of like a dual sword to it, right? It comes with immense privilege on the one hand. It's a form of security, a form of stability. It's a documentation. It's being recognized by institutions as I move through them. And at the same time, because of the climate we're in right now, there's also a precariousness to it because it can be taken away at any point. And especially with the conversations that are happening right now nationally and the toxicity of those conversations, that security has started to sort of like drift away. That intersects a lot with my transness. My citizenship is with Cyprus. So I'm Cypriot by nationality. And when my passport was about to expire back in December, I had to renew it, went to DC in November to do that, and figured it would be an opportunity for me to change my gender marker and my name in it. And folks at the embassy sort of really helped out to get all of this together. The problem is that my passport has still not been renewed, right? And the Cypriot government is still sort of holding on to it because they refuse to sort of provide an answer, not even say we're not going to do it, but even provide an answer as to if they're going to do it, when they're going to do it, what they need, want, et cetera. And so I find myself in this, like, I have a green card, but I'm trapped in this country. If poop really hits the fan, I can't like run off to Canada or even just be able to see my mother in Cyprus or my family in Armenia and so on. So I wanted to bring that up because I think sometimes we think in a lot of extremes in terms of any conversation around identity and subjectivity and positionality. And there's a lot of sort of middle grounds and cracks that we miss out on how some things get positioned. So to also think about sort of privilege in this really, really fluid way that isn't necessarily you either have privilege or you don't, but that even is precarious and changes by context and environment that we're in, or time and space, right?
Yeah, no, I appreciate you bringing that to light and allowing us to engage in that story. And thanks for being vulnerable with us and sharing that. That is an important conversation that I'm glad you uplifted. Now, folks that want to engage with you, TJ, and add you to their network, what's the best way to do that for them listening in?
I would say folks can feel free to look me up on LinkedIn. I show up there in my professional drag. And also on Twitter, TJ Jurian, just my full name. You can follow my cat on Instagram if you like, if you want that to be a sort of like escape route. She is Bella Bella the cat. She's wonderful. And I have a website, tjjurian.net. So it needs a serious overhaul. So again, don't judge and proceed with caution, but folks are free to peruse those.
Awesome. And what I'll do is I'll add those to the show notes. So for folks that are listening in, that will be at resilientcampus.com/23 for episode 23. Thank you so much, TJ, for being with us today. And as with every episode, we close out with an inspirational quote. And I would like to ask my good friend TJ to read that quote for us today.
And this comes from Leslie Feinberg, who was a huge hero for me for a really long time. And it says, surrendering is unimaginably more dangerous than struggling for survival.
Beautiful. To all those listening in, thank you so much for all that you do. I truly appreciate you. Stay resilient.
Thanks so much for tuning in. Head on over to iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher to subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss out on a single episode.